A different future starts with you. That's why GoDaddy does more than help you find a name. You can create, sell, and get found online, so any small business could be a driving force to create change or build an empire. We know old ideas aren't cutting it anymore, so we're calling for a new generation of thinking, your way of thinking. So whatever you have in mind that will help make a different future, find everything you need to get started at GoDaddy.com. Because the future isn't decided yet. It's up to us to make it happen. Start different at GoDaddy.com.
COVID-19 patients need your help.
If you've fully recovered from COVID-19
or unknowingly been exposed to it,
you may have the antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients recover.
Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies.
Visit Vitalant.org today to schedule an appointment to donate blood.
That's Vitalant.org. Help save lives and schedule your appointment at Vitalant.org.
You could help save lives.
This is an ode to Napa cabbage. Of all the cabbages on all the cabbage farms, only you have the crisp crunch worthy of our Bibigo Korean dumplings. No other cabbage would do, because no other cabbage tastes like you. We love you, Napa cabbage. Just don't tell Green Onion. Napa cabbage, one of many obsessively crafted ingredients in every hearty, flavorful Korean dumpling from Bibigo. Go handcrafted. Go Bibigo. Authentic Korean dumplings now in the freezer aisle.
This is Podco Media Networks.
It's the Innovation Podcast with Mark Reed Edwards and Garnett Harriman. Let's start the show.
Hey, everyone. It's Garnett. And instead of Mark today, we have Lane Jost, who used to do a takeover of the Innovation Podcast before, but he's my illustrious co-host today. Hey, Lane.
Hey, folks. Lane's back. How's everybody?
And we have a really cool guest today who's doing really innovative stuff in fintech, as well as in, I would say, emotional and mental wellness. And I know that may sound like, you know, I've yoked odd concepts together, but we'll get the explanation on that. And that's what's going to make this episode so fun. So our guest today is Maya Monell of Navit Money, an app that we're going to learn all about, as well as the Monell Family Foundation. I'm sorry I had to out you that way, Maya, but welcome.
That's okay, Garnett. Lane, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
All right. So it's worth telling everyone where everyone is today, because we're pretty much all over the map, right? Lane, where are you
Definitely.
At?
So I am in from beautiful Providence, Rhode Island.
Not just any part, right? Are you literally on the beach in Providence right now? Or
I'm a couple blocks from the Seekonk River, if you call that, which is a tidal river. So I suppose that's
close enough. Maya, where are you?
That's right.
I am in the Rocky Mountains in a place called Ketchum, Idaho. And so Lane and I are experiencing very different views, I think, out our windows right now.
So cool. Normally we would be getting the weather report from the compound and the independent sovereign nation that Mark Reed Edwards lives on. He has a compound of X number of acres that he, I believe, like Fela, the musician, he actually declared it independent. So today we're all over the place,
cool.
Providence, Idaho, and me in Laguna Beach. So let's jump into it. Maya, what is Navit Money, or is it just Navit?
And Navit, yeah, Navit, Navit Money, whatever you want to call it, Garnett, it is.
Okay, so Navit, what is it at a high level? And then don't go super deep into it, because I sort of skipped a step. I wanted to get, you know, your amazing background and, like, you know, what led up to this, because I know just enough to be dangerous about what you've done, what you've done in sports tech and what you did to get here, and the really sort of novel ideas that you're combining to try to look forward into the future of fintech. So
sure.
What is it in one line? And then what did you do to get here?
Sure. Thank you. So at Navit, we say we measure emotional and financial fitness to improve your grit mindset and overall financial opportunities. So that's the kind of the one-liner. And like you said before, we're consumer financial technology. So we use technology to build better financial solutions for our customer base. And in the second part of that question of why, how, and where I am right now, of how I got here.
Yeah, the full backstory. Don't spare any details.
Sure. So, you know, I mean, I don't know how far back you want me to go, but I majored in English and anthropology. as most English and anthropology grads know, that you can't really do a whole lot with that degree in business if you don't get something to supplement it. So I went back to grad school, to business school, focused in marketing and marketing strategy and innovation. I was fortunate enough to do that over in the UK. And during my time there, I also got to work on the Olympic campaign when the Olympics were being held in London, because I was working for a firm called Future Brand. And that really allowed me to see kind of the beauty and the passion around high-level sports and professional sports and the environment that, frankly, marketers could penetrate within that industry. So I moved back to the States shortly thereafter, and I went to San Francisco because, of course, I wanted to be in technology, and that's where everybody was going at the time. And in so doing, I landed at a small company called Bridge Athletic, and they were just getting off the ground, and they were building, they still are, we were building at the time, professional kind of software technology for professional coaches and athletes to try and help athletes perform at their best. And what that meant was providing a way for athletes to train anywhere in the world. Swimmers are most notorious for this, as a side note. You know, they never get an off season. So coaches needed a way to deliver content to their athletes from wherever they were at any point in the year to track how they were responding to different training patterns and habits over time. So that was fascinating. And I myself am an athlete. I grew up playing tennis and squash on the East Coast. So not originally from Idaho. I don't think I've ever seen a squash court in the state. And I felt really passionate about what we were doing. I mean, we were really supporting a young kind of budding group of athletes as well as the pros. I mean, we were working with, you know, the New York Rangers. I'm from New York. That was like heaven on earth to work with that team and go into those facilities. And I also got a really interesting viewpoint into the mindset and the struggles really of athletes, especially athletes that weren't at prime time. So the non-NFL players, the non-NBA players, and frankly, what a lot of those athletes had to overcome, especially as it pertained to their finances. You know, a lot of these athletes are not very well supported. Over 75% of them say that they don't feel any financial support from their national or international governing bodies. So, you know, I thought it was really fascinating to meet all these Olympic athletes, you know, these heroes of our sport and of our country, and realize that they're getting paid under $20,000 a year. That really shocked me. Exactly. I was also, you know, the one woman on the leadership team in a very kind of male dominant industry and environment. And so I focused on and really just gained rapport with a lot of these female athletes. And that just, I think, kind of led me down this road into financial services from a very strange roundabout way to focus in on why these, frankly, inequities existed within financial services, why these heroines of sport didn't feel supported in their financial opportunities, you know, what was lacking from both kind of a government regulation environment, but also what was lacking in really their own financial acumen and literacy. Fast forward, I met my now co-founder, Aaron Papworth, here in Somali. We were put together by an executive coach, and the coach said, you know, listen, I hear what you're starting to realize that your true passion is, which is financial services, which is a strange thing to say that you're passionate about, but I truly am, and fixing some of the issues that we have in the industry. And she said, you know, I think you should get together with Aaron. She's a behavioral scientist, and she's trying to figure out a better way to not only educate, but provide resources and tools to people that have historically felt left out of the conversation of financial services. Fast forward, Erin and I founded Navit. She really founded the concept, and then she brought me in to figure out how we could actually kind of quantify what we were seeing in professional sport, a different way to evaluate your passion, your resilience, your grit, and how these things could actually help improve your financial opportunities over time. And so at Navit, that's what we're doing. We're really leveraging on the work that's already been done for us across different industries like sports and performance, like mindset tracking, you know, like the Headspaces of the world and the Calms of the world, as well as in the nutritional space, like the Nooms, to realize that you can actually change your financial behaviors through incremental daily habits. And that's what we're focused on.
Very cool. So I have Blaine, and you should jump in because there's no reason we should be doing this sequentially. We can just, you know, stitch together our respective questions and make stuff up as we go forward. So I'm a lifelong runner, And my boyhood idol was Sir Sebastian, now Sir Sebastian Coe. Was he active? Did you run into him at all at any of your, like, you know, I don't know, gathering?
I did not. But again, we were like over-indexed in aquatics, at least at Bridge. So
okay, got it. That's really my only big question.
That's it. Okay, we can go home now.
I wanted to see if you had met my boyhood idol, because then you know, I could do some transference to you.
No, unfortunately not. I have met a couple of my tennis idols though, and so that was pretty cool. And I've met both the Williams sisters, and I grew up in South Florida, so that was, I mean, or I say early 2000s, Serena Williams is the Navid archetype, like. That's no secret.
There you go.
I hope she allows me to say that on this thing if she's listening. You know.
Yeah. Wow.
So speaking of, Maya, thank you for giving us that interesting. So the intersection between sports, your personal experience, and then your professional experience around sort of sports as a marketing tool, and then sort of, if I can say, the sort of social justice platform of sports, which today is as important as ever. And then taking that down to something as specific as financial education, leveraging, you know, software as a service to solve behavior. Mm-hmm. What an interesting road. We all come to these roads of clarity in different ways.
Yeah, we do.
So thank you for sharing that with us. Tell us a little bit more with Navid. You know, you've shared with us the concept, the macro of the problem you're trying to solve. Give us a little, not too deep, but tell us a little bit about what audience you're trying to reach and how they will use Navid.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, so every advisor I think we've ever had at Navid says the way to make it in financial services, especially in early days, is to focus on a micro segment. So we're going to focus on a micro segment. No, we are. And I think, you know, we are, because of our language, because of who we are as founders, because of the ways that we're building these different tools, you know, we don't believe that automation should be everything. We believe automation should help you make better human decisions and have better human interactions in your life. So there's a lot of kind of human components to the app that don't ring true, maybe some of our competitors. And so I think that we naturally gravitate towards a health conscious consumer. Our sweet spot, we're a fintech, our sweet spot is between 22 and 35 of earners. And, you know, that's an earner of in different ways. That could be an hourly worker with a couple of jobs, but that make up about an HHI or household income of around 40K and above. So it's people that are living over the poverty line, but by no means am I calling them stable. Certainly some are. And like I said, I think we attract the audience that understands us because they use Headspace, they use Noom, they use Nike Training Club. They have, you know, they maybe even go to Equinox or once when we were allowed to go to the gym, you know, all these things. But we also have, you know, a more hopeful, frankly, and larger segment of users that are starting to come in who see the value of not just the budgeting tools or the auto savings or even the literacy, but see the value of what we're calling our financial well-being score, which truly does take not just financial health metrics like your ability to pay down debt or your ability to save for a rainy day, but also things like how you measure your own self-efficacy, how you feel about different expenditures, how you are building a more resilient or what we call grit mindset, and how that should also play into how the banking community views you as a customer. And that's really what we're trying to build over time. It's still early days, but, you know, Aaron and I think all of our advocates and allies believe that your credit score does not make up who you actually are as a human being. And you're so much more than that. And that's what we're trying to prove with alternative ways to evaluate your creditworthiness. And that's what we're doing.
Let me ask a quick follow-up.
You're a parent. And the only context that I have for this word grit as an indication of like either personal or intellectual or emotional well-being is in the context of these books that have come out in the last 5 or 7 years about how to raise grit kids to be more whatever.
Gritty?
That's it.
Gritty. No, truly gritty.
So apparently it's okay to have gritty kids, but you can't have gritty food or gritty residue or anything like that. So... But I want to drill down on that because I was fascinated just reading the book reviews because I'm too lazy to read the book about the intellectual component of grit and like all of the richness that can be unpacked. So how do you think about grit?
Yeah. So I wonder if you're referencing Duckworth.
Probably.
She's the professor at UPenn, I believe, Angela Duckworth. And so she was one of kind of the pioneers of this concept of early childhood grit. And I mean, you know, I'm an athlete. Like I said, I am a really hard worker. I believe in the effort score just as much as I do the overall grade. And so from a personal perspective, I've practiced grip my whole life because not everything has come really easily to me. And that's basically the same premise, is to say, you know, if you have passion and you have perseverance and you know what you want out of a certain outcome, then you're more likely to succeed on your grit and the way in which you get from point A to point B than just talent or intellect alone.
Is grit teachable? I want to get down to the, no pun intended, the nitty gritty. Is grit teachable?
It is. And I highly, highly recommend Duckworth's book titled Grit. It's brilliant. And it's probably like the doctrine of Navit. It's definitely the doctrine of Aaron, my co-founder.
That must be what I was reading the review of.
Probably. Probably. No, it's a brilliant read. And it is teachable. And it's to focus on the things you can control, the mindset that you have when you work towards those things, and how you can foster mindfulness today to improve your outcomes tomorrow. So there's a lot around habitual action, daily mindfulness practice. I mean, you know, in our app, we have a mindfulness score and it's one of our kind of daily engagements, right? Where you come in and you say, like, just checking in, how do you feel about your money today? And then what makes you feel that way about your money? And so that over time, just like we do, you know, I'm wearing a fitness tracker right now, just like we do with our fitness or our nutrition or our, you know, mindfulness practice or like sleep pattern, let's say, in the term of headspace, we can start to see our trends over time and use those trends to make more informed decisions if we're not happy about our existing outcomes. And so this is where I think grit is really impactful. It's to say, like, you know, try again. That's the determinant of grit, right? It's the kids that get back up after they fail, not those that never fail in the first place.
Let me ask about this. I mean, so, you know, this concept of grit, which, and I, by the way, just in full disclosure, I have not read the book that you recommended. We'll definitely add it in the show notes. Although I think I've maybe seen a TED talk or two.
She's and
I've
done
read,
one, yeah.
You know, some cover. So, you know, I have not read I really would like to. I mean, grit in the context of financial education has gotten a little bit of academic mileage. It's also a little bit more, there's a little bit more mileage when you think about some of the management gurus of our time, like Adam Grant. Mm-hmm. I think even Malcolm Gladwell maybe has a podcast on the concept of grit. But I want to focus on your thinking, like how you think about grit in the context of Navit, because it's really interesting. So as you well know, as you both well know, there's this widely overused cliche in business, specifically in the sustainability ESG impact investing world that I reside in, which is, you know, whatever gets measured gets managed, which I'm sure you guys have heard a million times. And, you know, hopefully the days are over where people will just mention that at a conference and everyone's just like, that person's so smart. Because what I've learned is it's actually not so simple, but I'm interested, and let me explain this. I'm not just trying to be clever. I'm trying to ask you, so I'm hearing about Navit, and it's just this like very holistic way of measuring leading indicators of grit. So how you're feeling about the money in your checking account, or how you're feeling about the money in your savings account. And I'm sure a lot of other really thoughtful things. I think what you're saying with Navit conceptually, and I want to, and just tell me if I'm dead wrong, is that there's ways to manage and measure things if they're done in the right holistic, sequential way. Is that kind of your thinking? And does my paraphrasing this overused, you know, measure and manage thing resonate, or is that just wrong or react?
Reaction. You know, it's a really good question. And it's a really great hypothesis to say that, you know, if we do things in the certain, if we take this path and we hit all of these mile markers, then we'll surely hit the finish line on time, right? And I think that that's fundamentally untrue. I think the components that we're trying to bring in is this more human approach to your overall financial roadmap, right? So that, you know, I often say, and I love illustration, I'm a marketer, excuse this, but, you know, Navit is just a roadmap. It's just a tool in your toolkit to make sure that you get to your final destination. If you decide to take the back road because you want the more scenic route, that's totally cool. Just like Google Maps, Navit should recalibrate to help you get, again, to take you through the scenic route and then get you to where you want to be. And so I think that actually grit is like the fundamental driver of this realization that you can't actually just get from point A to point B on a linear path, or that doesn't always happen, I should say, right? It's to say that, you know, we could assume that if we all study really, you know, say we're all back at getting an MBA, right? If we all studied really hard for whatever, our finance exam, that surely we're all going to be at the top 5% of the class. We're all going to get A's. That's not actually true, right? There could be some kind of unforeseen barrier that impacted our study regimen, or we could just frankly not care about the topic. We could just not have, I could not have as profound of a level of passion for finance as Garnett does. This just could be like fundamentally based.
I was going to say, you must have been a fly on the wall during my MBA finance classes because
well,
that wasn't my thing.
Admittedly, it wasn't mine either. But that might mean that we actually have more grit because we've had to overcome some more materials, right?
More fellow feeling and more human understanding, I suspect.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think, you know, if I, again, can kind of provide a better illustration maybe is to say there's this big conversation right now in our industry between insolvency and illiquidity as a mechanism of evaluating creditworthiness and like who's actually capable of seeing financial outcomes that they want, or at least hitting financial stability. We see that in COVID right now a lot, right? I mean, people who are on hourly or some kind of varying income are not able to cover their daily expenses, are not able to hit, you know, a certain milestone, are not able to pay for their mortgage, blah, blah, blah. And the reason why I bring this up is to say, you know, we could tell that person who has variable income to budget, you know, for X fixed expenses every single month, make sure they do that, and surely they'll be okay. But we all know with variable income, that's not how the world works, right? You could be making much more in January because of, you know, it's the holiday season and you work for a service industry than you might in March. And I think that this is an important note in terms of grit, because it's to say that we should be evaluating you and your ability and your desire to pay down your debt, pay off your expenses, et cetera, even if that variable income means that you fall maybe at the average poverty line or just above it, right? Just because you don't hit our income brackets, or just because you're afraid of the banking system and you don't want to use credit because you're afraid of credit, doesn't mean that you're any less able of paying down a small dollar loan. And I think that that's, I'm like getting to this in a roundabout way, but the point being that, you know, if we can use the more human like characteristics of who you are as a banking customer, then we might be able to, you know, frankly, get you cheaper loans to help you pay down debt and frankly, make your money cheaper for you. We all know that money is least expensive for, you know, the highest income brackets in our country, right? And so we're trying to frankly combat that profound issue that frankly, nobody else is going to do.
Do you want to talk a little bit? This feels like a good segue. I'm struggling with like how much candor to apply to this, because you brought up something that hits really close to home, you know, around this notion of, you've hit it from a couple of different directions, actually, and from the behavioral analysis and behavioral management side of things on a micro level, on a personal individual level. And then you hit it, you know, from the standpoint around insolvency versus illiquidity. Mm-hmm. And so at a very high level, I'm going to share. So this is someone with an Ivy League degree and an MBA, and I confess to having credit card troubles in my 20s. And the vignette that I like to share with people, which is now a badge of honor, but it caused me a great deal of personal shame for years, was something that, you know, might strike a chord for Navid. If it ends up in your feature stack, you're going to have to write me into the equity. So
I will.
For a period of time, it took me about a year to essentially train myself out of it. I ran a daily P&L for myself, daily. And
oh my God,
as you can imagine, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, and I can tell you that it worked out well, but, you know, it was tough for the first X number of weeks and months, and then it got progressively easier. And now it's literally, Lane, you'll appreciate the resonance with the conversation you and I had with Steve. It's gone to the point where basically, you know, I now have that like five-figure cash sum that we talked about in the past, hidden in the go bag, just in case bad shit happens somewhere. Look, and so I'm not suggesting any of this is normal, but a lot of the sort of erudite, you know, and sophisticated ways that Navid is trying to deal with things, you know, strikes a chord personally. And I'll leave it at that because.
Thank you. No, I appreciate that. And I appreciate you giving us that anecdote. I mean, I think that it does for a whole bunch of people. You know, frankly, we've just started a student, this is an aside, we've just started a student ambassador program targeting undergrads. And we did it. But yeah, but exactly. We did it because we had some interns, and interns were like, do you know what credit cards are doing on campuses, Maya? And I was like, no, I don't. Tell me more.
I stumbled out of my dorm room and I had the last week of Columbia, and I had an Amex gold card, you know, before I hit College Walk. as a humanities undergrad, I had from a lower middle class family, I had a pretty serious deficit of financial knowledge, right? It's terrible.
It's shocking. It's shocking to see what these kids are going through, and frankly, to see the younger millennials not only graduating and going through their first stages of work with incredible student debt, but now that high interest credit card debt is actually surpassing their rate in student debt. And so, I mean, we have these conversations. And again, these are kids that are working, they could be working on Wall Street. They could be making $150K out of college. And they're like, yeah, but I need Navit because A, I have no idea what you've just said to me about high interest credit card debt. And B, I have a lot of that and I need to figure out how to pay it off. And so back to the question of who our audience is, I'm like, I used to say that our audience is first time financial enthusiasts. It's really anybody that realizes that they need a healthier approach to dealing with financial stress. And 90% of our American workforce right now are financially stressed. So we can call it a micro segment. Ideally, it touches a lot more people than that.
It's that holistic and contextual thing that, even the most well-educated kids at age 23 or 22, you can't possibly, unless you were born with a financial manager that talks to you weekly, you can't possibly have that level of context and holistic, to Lane's earlier point, understanding.
No.
You can't.
Exactly. No, you can't.
If you've recovered from COVID-19 or unknowingly been exposed to it, you may have antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients. Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies. Visit Vitalant.org today.
So I don't want to add to the gloom, but I'm going to jump in for a second.
I'm used to it in our industry.
and Maya, this is sort of a comment, but also would love to take it back to you and how you think about Navit's kind of trajectory and roadmap. And so, I mean, it's delicate to say this, but I'll say it anyway. I mean, so obviously the focus in the nonprofit world, and, as you probably well know, Maya, the banking world, because of the Community Reinvestment Act, actually has to invest in financial education, and does so at varying levels of incompetence based on, slush money handed out to nonprofits. And I did that for a little while. And, we have lots of inefficiencies. So we have the American banking system, which people, I think, kind of understand redlining wasn't like this isolated incident that a couple of bad apples in the American capitalist system did. Like, this was a systemic effort to define credit as not lending to poor Black people living in cities at the mid-century when white people were leaving. And as a white person, I feel very compelled to speak very transparently about this, not just for this sort of white man's burden thing, but I'm still shocked at this. I think more people should be horrified.
Should
and
be.
I think the CRA, the banks that actually give away millions and billions of CRA eligible credits because they have to, because of the federal government, the American consumer is not remotely familiar with the force on a lot of this money that goes and supports communities. And some of it is great work, supports community development organizations, a lot of it in the financial education programmatic space across the US. But people know very little about this.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I want to make, though, about financial acumen, personal, the conversation typically focuses in the policy, but also in the nonprofit world around underbanked, around low to moderate income people, around minorities. That is all true. But what it's missing is actually, it's really everyone across the income distribution. Mm-hmm. And it also, the roots of it, I think, in America specifically have a lot to do with the intergenerational wealth transfer about how wealth was amassed. So if you look at America at a very high level, the rise of the middle class, right? I mean, people, now credit, mortgages weren't necessarily cheap, but wages were decent. Wages were growing and people could access houses in ways that they will never be able to again, as we sit and talk here today, because of the growth of the real estate market. So the traditional American wealth creation tool, the house, mm-hmm. is now almost going to be beyond the reach of people, particularly on the low end of the income distribution.
Mm-hmm.
So the management skills, the grit, the acumen becomes the only real tool for people to survive. Not to be so dramatic. So I'd love for you to just respond to this like broader context of like how to live in 2020 as a millennial in the next generations. And like, what are going to be, in addition to technology and apps and grit, like it's tough out there. And I think financial education, I think, is now becoming a little bit more. So I think in the across the country, financial education is becoming a little bit more mandated in middle and upper school public systems.
Only in 4 states.
But you're shaking your head. Yeah. So like, talk a little bit about like the systemic failure and how you see technology and other elements coming to bear on this.
Yeah.
This is a big problem.
It's a huge problem. Love the question. Could probably speak to it.
Sorry, it took me like 7 minutes to ask.
That's okay. You know, we might be here a while, but I'll try and stay brief. Brevity is not my strong suit. When banks were deregulated, it was really this is really when we saw the demise of underbanking in our country. Right. And I think that
time frame 70s, 80s.
Yeah. 70s. And then in the 90s, there was, it was like, don't ask me to maybe 74. You know, it was around the same time women got access to credit. Let's just say that. But, you know, I mean, this has been going on, like you said, Lane, you know, since the dawn of our nation, right? Where Jefferson and Hamilton were battling out if there should be one centralized bank, you know, that was a federally mandated bank, or if the state should have control. And the whole premise was, it was like Jefferson was right in the short term and the state should have control so that there wasn't such a gravitation towards, you know, city wealth, right? And so that the fighting farmer could have a fighting chance. But we no longer live in that world. When the Industrial Revolution happened, the concept of secured income changed, right? And frankly, with the tech boom happening and the gig economy and now all the things that we've seen in really like the last 20, 25 years, the concept has shifted again. So not only can we not find affordable places to just live if we want to move out of the city, you know, like that was the thing to do, right? Now it's even harder because we are entering into workforce. I say we, you know, millennials, younger people and older people and the like, are entering into a different type of workforce. Not only are they forced to figure out, you know, whatever their, however they can support their livelihood, but they're also not given the security by their employer, right? Pensions have shifted into 401ks. And that's a huge, I think, frankly, a huge and overlooked component to this conversation, because not only are we amassing more debt, we're also more susceptible to those emergencies that are happening more and more frequently. So now you have Dave Ramsey and Sue Orman saying, you need to save 8 months of your paycheck for an emergency, which is truly inconceivable. So many issues.
I want to respond to that point. Can I respond to that point, Maya? So from my personal reaction to personal finance, which let me just say could be a lot better. I'll just keep it there for now because it could. No one wants to hear about
it's another podcast.
You know, two kids. And I also just want to be clear. I mean, I grew up with a lot, and you know, and I for me it's more like how do I till the garden and manage a career, and so. But I will say just back to Navit, and I do want to hear the rest of your response. Like personal finance person I've like met with over this last handful of years, as I think about really growing up and having somebody help me do this, I like walk away, A, feeling like that person's on crack. B, I feel really badly about myself and I'm totally screwed, even though I already knew that I was. And C, I think I'm just going to like quit being an adult. So.
We all have really healthy relationships with our money, you know, obviously. It's why we're all, you know, so tranquil about our financial futures. Now, I think, like I said, there are so many systemic barriers to why people cannot generate meaningful wealth in this country. Certainly half the population who live at slightly above or certainly below the poverty line struggle with this issue immensely. And yet at the same time, you know, I think our industry has told them that if they just made better choices, that all their problems would go away. That if they just saved 8 months of their income for an emergency that might or might not happen, they'd be fine. And that's just simply not the case. People are living paycheck to paycheck because they have to live paycheck to paycheck, not because they're not gritty, not because they've never sat in a financial course before, like not because all the other things that frankly our income bracket like to tell them, because we're still in a public policy of shaming the poor. And that is what I'm fundamentally disappointed and also driven by, because it's just not right. I mean, frankly, I would tell you most of the people that I've encountered that live within, below their means, live under, at the poverty line, no matter for whatever reason, right, know way more about money management than I do. And that's just like hands down, because guess what? They have to. You know, like Lane, you and I were very fortunate. I grew up in a very safe, stable environment. Like maybe that's the reason why I feel so passionate about this topic, because I had literally every access and opportunity handed and available to me. And I think that if we don't come to terms with the reality that half of our population need a better banking solution, need better access to small dollar lending so that they can maybe not only meet, you know, the car emergency or whatever the family emergency it is, but also meet, you know, an asset generating opportunity, then we should be giving them that. We should not be in the business of making more money off the people that are frankly like building our economy.
So I'm going to recount the structural barriers that I think I heard. And you tell me if I'm missing anything. Redlining. Redlining is our personal bête noire. I mean, you know, I've studied it a lot. Lane has studied it a lot. We're both deeply involved in opportunity zones, and opportunity zones are obviously, you know, a direct response to what happened. Is that, I think it's the Federal Home Lending Act, right? Of like 38 or 48. I forget what year it was. And so that one, banking deregulation, it makes perfect sense. I wouldn't have actually, that wouldn't have been immediate for me. So that's, I appreciate that one. And then this dubious policy nexus, right, about blaming the poor or giving them effectively undoable advice.
Yeah.
So any other big structural issues going on?
Well, I think all of those center around the general theme that we've worked very hard as a country to quantify a banking opportunity. The reason why we've done that is because it's made the banking system easier, right? Like if we have quantifiable metrics to say to somebody that comes through the door or comes through an app or whatever it is that, you know, you're the more likely lending candidate, and this is why we're going to give you a loan at this rate for this term rather than you, then, you know, you're a much safer bet. And with things like deregulation, you know, we've allowed banks to get away with that. We've allowed them to stray from servicing community and the betterment of society and move into the betterment of profitability. And I think that that's really the key theme to all of those key barriers, right? Is to say that we've allowed the industry to get away with so much for so long that it's now really hard to scale back and look to things like CDFIs and say, you know, okay, they are going to help this unbanked portion, almost majority of our country, right? They're still incentivized by profit, not by community good. And one of the key, I think, illustrations of this is that, you know, frankly, in part due to technology, is we no longer take the borrower's character into consideration. And that's essentially, and maybe I should start leading with that, but that's essentially what we're trying to do with this grit score. And essentially what we're trying to do at Navit is to say, even in the age of technology, even in the age of COVID, even when you no longer know your banker because he's no longer your neighbor, my character should still count for something.
That's where I was going with like listing what I thought I had heard, these big barriers, structural and systemic barriers. I wanted to drill it down into like a specific feature. It feels in Navit or consumer fintech in general. And it feels like the score, that was my conclusion. It feels like the score is going to end up being the Neo score. I don't know. You're calling it the grit score, right?
We call it financial well-being, but you know, it's your financial well-being score. It's taking the quantitative, but it's also taking a way in which we can measure the qualitative components and marrying them together. Because, you know, like our parents did, we think that you should be able to walk into a bank and be judged on your character as well as, you know, your other financial kind of credentials. And so like our 10-year goal is for every institution, at least in our country, to be using the financial well-being score as supplemental or as an additive to, you know, your creditworthiness or your credit score to prove your creditworthiness.
So Lane, I'm struck by, and Maya, you know, this came up in our first conversation with William. I am struck by two ideas that Navit is playing with and maybe is going to end up bringing to the masses in a way that not even the, you know, the organization I'm about to talk about did. But it really feels like Grameen. It really feels like, you know, the birth of social peer group based lending. Right. I mean, the twin pillars of the Grameen system from back in the day was microloans, right? effectively peer-to-peer, but no, actually, that's not true. They were not peer-to-peer. They were actually, you know, it was actually a lending institution, but micro amounts. Mm-hmm. And then as I understood it, you know, you couldn't, quote, graduate or like, you know, the thing that Grameen did was make it social, right? So there was a peer group, almost like a review process or mm-hmm. an approval process. So if Maya, Lane, and Garnett are a group and mm-hmm. Lane gets the first amount of money, you know, Maya doesn't get money and Garnett doesn't get money until Lane gets some sort of repayment milestone, right. If not 100% repayment. And so the, quote, peer pressure aspect of the whole thing was just astonishingly insightful. Mm-hmm. And I struggle with this thing, you know, with this notion of character, but it feels like you're really playing in the two areas that the Grameen Bank, you know, was and is playing with that, you know, won him the Nobel Prize, to be honest.
Totally. I mean, Grameen is definitely a North Star. I mean, there are definitely things that cannot be replicated in that model. I think we're talking much more about an individual approach because we're reaching a broader market. I mean, we're tech, right? So we're not talking about the physical community, we're talking about the online community, which is different. And so that's where Grameen doesn't necessarily work in maybe the US model. You know, Bank of Chicago, that was a good example, or Chicago Institute, I'll have to rethink that. A good example of micro lending as well. I think the larger notion here too is to say, you know, Navit, if we become a bank one day, great. We've served our purpose. We're doing what we're trying to do. But at the end of the day, Aaron and I's mission is to have that score be used across all financial institutions. And that's to say, no matter where you want to bank, do so, but make sure it's with purpose, right? Make sure that that's the most advantageous bank supporting, you know, your unique needs, and let us help you ensure that you're going to get the cheapest value, you know, for your money.
Yeah, and I'd love to ask you, Garnett, I think just if I could follow up on the sort of Grameen sort of inspiration, let's say, for you, Maya, which is, so, I mean, just to quickly summarize, so Grameen, you know, let's just think about Grameen as a innovation tool for the unbanked. So, you know, Dr. Yunus, Muhammad Yunus, you know, goes to Bangladesh, which, of course, you know, he's an economist, a Western-trained economist. He goes back to his native Bangladesh. For those of you out there that don't know the story, what does he discover? He discovers artisans in Bangladesh, mainly women, who are like, what is their main constraint as an entrepreneur? It's actually access to capital, to scale up. And his hypothesis with the Grameen model is, okay, credit constraint or capital constraint, that's actually what the cap for these people to earn more, to live above the poverty line, to help their families. Experiments with what Garnett was talking about, which is the joint liability contract, which is essentially lending circles. You have six women. It's a six-week cycle. What's cool about the joint liability contracts is for 5 weeks, people get a savings account. And then for, you know, 1 week, people get a lending account, which is kind of the way that worked through securitization and peer pressure. So that's kind of a cool idea. And the community development world has scaled up microfinance, microlending in different, you know, a decade ago, that Grameen vision. All of a sudden, you had banks in developing economy countries. There was one very notable in Mexico about 15 years ago called Compartamos or WeShare, which IPO'd a microfinance model. But what's interesting about that, and I'll get to my question, which is they got crushed by the sort of Western media because they were using the mechanisms of Western banking finance, you know, interest rates to figure out risk, right? So to your point about like changing the system to adding this grit and character component, the question is like, what is the real vision of Navit and how Navit can quantify qualitative factors in an app?
Yeah. So we can look to a lot of these models to prove that out. So basically you're asking how we're measuring that character metric, right? How we're measuring, yeah, grit. So one of the ways we're doing that is we're looking at your month over month stress and emotional resilience. We call it resilience. It equates to grit, but you know, the two kind of are interchangeable. And that's why I say that we're marrying emotional and financial fitness, because I think it's that emotional fitness that speaks to grit as we now know it, thanks to Duckworth and others. But what we do are a couple of different things. So we're measuring the emotional fitness and your ability to change how you feel about these transactions, which include your savings and investment criteria over time. We're also bringing in the community side of that because we really believe in like peer-to-peer motivation. I think one of the key things that have been missed in most, again, automated savings, automated budgeting tools, automated, is that human component. And we actually, as humans, learn best from each other. And so we have a community feed that operates a lot like a Venmo feed. it's de-identified because I hate that one part of Venmo, but it's a way to say, you know, 80% of users hit their savings goal this month. Do you want to create your own? CCTA hit button. You know, there are a lot of things too that are comparable metrics that the younger generation seems to really feel motivated by as well, is to say, gosh, I live in Manhattan. I'm spending this amount of money on food and bev every month. What's the comparison of those living in Ohio spending on that? You know, we're trying to figure out how to include this peer-to-peer educational model to help you make more informed, or frankly, even build confidence in your decision-making. Something that's been really profound in our user base that we've found over time is like just this lack of confidence. And I think that that then speaks back to this lack of grit, or this way to build up grit, I should say. It's to say, you've done so much in your life. You've been knocked down so many times. You've done all these things. You've persevered. You're on this road to success, or whatever you're trying to accomplish in your life, because most of us have intrinsic motivations that like drive us through life. You haven't been given those same tools or so same reference points in terms of your financial like history and opportunity. And we want to really be that guide. We want to be that coach. You know, it's, I often equate it back to the financial or the fitness model of like Navit customers are my athletes. And, you know, I'm one of the many coaches, because all of these things are simple. All of these concepts around financial modeling and opportunities and success, they're all really easy to figure out if you've been given that roadmap. And so things like the money mindset features, things like the community features, things like automated savings and other tools that really do help, you know, you make better financial choices over time, change your behavior, and furthermore, your outlook on where you will be and what you need to do in order to succeed in whatever metric success means to you. Does that answer the question?
Female entrepreneurship. Is there anything organically embedded in the Navit mindset, the Navit perspective that speaks to that experience? Because that's essentially your experience on some level. And what would it be?
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, well, Aaron and I are, you know, one of the very, very few, if not the only, on kind of our trajectory for financial technology. So we're constantly told we can't do it because we don't come from Wall Street. And so I think grit is intrinsically within the both of us. She's a single mom. I think grit is also intrinsically in her.
There you go.
And I think that that really speaks to, frankly, the value and the ways in which we've built the MVP and how we're building off of those services. I think community, frankly, is one of the key pillars and the key differentiators in our product. It might not be like the pinnacle to the overall financial well-being score, which, you know, equates your creditworthiness or measures your creditworthiness, but it does speak to who A, we are as founders, and B, the value of communal learning and, you know, gathering in that sense. Like these are typically feminine characteristics of, you know, sharing knowledge.
Yep. Well,
and I think that that's a key component. And frankly, then of course the emotional lens, it's like, we're not afraid to embrace our emotions. I've had many exec coaches tell me that I'm too exuberant and I talk too much and I laugh too much in interviews and I do all this and I do all that. And I'm like, fucking care. Like, but like, do you want me to not say that I'm a girl? I don't understand. So, you know, I think that there are just things that we do in a different frame of mind. And if we attract more women than men, then so be it.
Well said.
Yeah, because men are doing such a great job with personal finance.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, they're all there on Wall Street with their calculators and making all their decisions and their trades. We're just here sitting at home.
Busily excluding people.
Yeah. Yeah. So... Honestly, what surprised me most is we have a 50-50 split in user base. I'm not sure how that happened because my entire content team are women, but
wow,
great. Yeah,
that's interesting. Well, I think you're hitting on maybe like a latent demand, you know, when you slice it by gender.
I like to call them, you know, my woke males.
There you go.
I think that there are a lot of men, especially in the younger demographics. Frankly, it was the younger demographics that told us that they didn't jive, they didn't resonate with an exclusive message. So even when, you know, our beta version was speaking to women, female millennials, because we were them and we understood them, but we had a bunch of youngers come to us and say, we're not going to keep up with this if I can't use it with my roommate or my partner or my brother or whomever it might be.
Interesting. So we're getting toward the end of the time that we have. And before, I have a, I don't know, habitual final parting question That's about your take on the future, your predictions on the future. But before we get to that, I want to give Lane an opportunity to ask anything that he may want to ask at this point, based on this incredibly engaging and wide-ranging and shockingly intellectual discussion with both Lane and Maya.
Well, let me just ask Maya real quickly. Just can you give, you mentioned like your user split. Can you give, just give us like, I don't know, give your 1 to 3 year kind of user roadmap, like just high level, like what's your goals around like user penetration?
Product roadmap too. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to keep some of my cards close, but are you asking who my users, who I hope my users will be?
Just give us a sense of like what you're, no, I'm just high level, like how many users, where are you today? Where do you want to be in a year? However you want to cut it.
Yeah, in a year, you know, in a year, I'd like to see over 100,000 downloads. We have a 50% conversion rate to registration right now. So I'd like to see that continue. We have next to zero marketing dollars. So I'm really thrilled with that. But obviously, you know, we're just closing up our seed round of funding right now. And that's focused on a 60-40 split between product and growth. And, you know, there's a really interesting opportunity for us in the employee benefit space. And I'm not saying that I'm going to pivot or different, or I don't know what other words I could call it. I'm not saying that I'm splitting my time or my team's focus between two very different segments and two very different propositions, but I am saying that it's an interesting distribution strategy for us and one that I'm willing to explore because we're having employers come to us saying that they have no way to measure both emotional and financial fitness together. So that's been an interesting conversation to have. And as it pertains to health insurers and frankly, financial brokerage firms as well, the tool can be used in many different ways for just a whole host of different people. So I'm frankly really excited in the next few years to see if we can in fact do what we're saying and prove that financial well-being is a key metric for success in your financial roadmap.
Let me just give you a quick plug on the employee benefits. I'm going to call it marketplace development. I'm not going to call it a pivot.
Thank you.
Which is, you know, in the ESG space more broadly, like one of the biggest stakeholder themes, really investor themes over the COVID period, but even before COVID, is around the employees, around employee voice. And more specifically, like, you know, the basic things like, are you paying your employees enough money to survive economic shocks? But then more specifically, are you providing, you know, work from home? Are you providing even ancillary support for work from home things like monitors? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I will just tell you that a strong endorsement that there's an opportunity there for you as stakeholder pressure on companies to think about employee wellness goes well beyond compensation. Yeah. It goes to mindfulness, which has been, you know, sexy in the corporate world for about five, 6 years now. But connecting it to personal finance is wide open, but increasingly now the expectation of kind of human capital, human capital purview in public companies. Right. So, and there's not a lot of, to my knowledge, there's not a lot of tech products that are as holistic and nuanced as you've articulated today. So
thank you.
Go get that.
I will definitely try. And I will say, speaking back to what we spoke about earlier, I would say the reason why we're so focused on employee well-being and financial well-being now is because we've lacked an opportunity to provide that level of stability for our workforce because of the things we've already talked about.
I can't hear stuff like this without asking a question. So I'm going to ask Lane a question about you, and then you should chime in. Hey, would you go after corporate foundations as a way of sort of creating a toehold at corporations, Lane? Could that be any, because, you know, the sell into the employee benefits folks are going to, it's going to take forever, right? Whereas the foundation sell may go faster. I don't know. What do you think?
I think I would actually disagree. I actually think if you can, like any entrepreneurial funding trajectory, if you can create the currency of users faster, that's obviously what you want to be doing. The corporate foundation space, as Maya, you probably well know, it still thinks about this in a very old school kind of way. You all are obviously a commercial venture, even with a mission that you have. You know, they're going to look at you like a business, not like they should, which is a progressive business. And I mean, the question is right on. I actually think in this case, it's better to go straight to the economic buyer.
There you go. Market development. All right.
I love it.
There you go. Dr. VC, free advice on how to scale and fund your company.
I'll be back very soon. I think we should do these weekly now. Thanks.
There you go. There you go. And I'm just going to say, you know, in the spirit of just helping you understand why Lane and I work together, Lane is one of the best investment analysts and like sort of, you know, startup thinkers that I've met in the last decade. And for the entire time I've known him, he's not worked at a startup. So go figure, you know.
It's really good to be good at something you don't have to like execute against, right?
It's the dream.
Well, you help a lot of people execute, so all good. So here's my favorite way of ending the podcast, and thank you in advance for having been here. But get up on your soapbox, give me a prediction or two about 2021 or 2022. Anything, sports scores, you know.
Well,
where the striped bass are going to be running. I don't care. Just give me.
Well, you know, I want to start and end with sports, but I will say
good.
2021 good. Will be the year that Serena has a true comeback and wins another title.
Holy smoke. Okay.
So here's hoping that I'm right. And in terms of financial services, I mean, I think, you know, with a new administration comes new opportunities for regulatory control. And I think that, like you both articulated, the industry, whether or not it be B2C or B, is becoming more and more approachable and interested in the whole self and the whole customer and the whole character of a human. And I think that that's really exciting to see. And I hope to see some progress in 2021 around what that means for the banking customer.
And by 2022, Navit will have its own bank charter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, duh, of course. Because things like that happen overnight.
Well, you know, if you raise enough money, you can get away with murder. You know, witness WeWork.
Yeah. I will be happy if we've proved our hypothesis that financial well-being includes grittiness.
Yep. Yep. Well, I find it super innovative. So I'm really grateful that you came on and took all this time with us. And this is now our second or third conversation. So I'm hoping we'll have you back and we'll talk
Love
more
it.
About, you know, what's going on.
No, thank you all so much for having me. I'm really excited to get this out into the world.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks for joining Garnett and Mark on the Innovation Podcast. Visit theinnovationpodcast.co to subscribe and listen to other episodes.